In Turkey, people are heading to the polls in a historic presidential runoff between incumbent Erdogan and opposition leader Kılıçdaroğlu. Dozens of Israeli settlers, heavily guarded by Israeli forces, once again break into the Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied Al-Quds. And Ukraine reports fresh Russian drone attacks on capital Kiev, while signs of Moscow has eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut. I'm Behruz Najafi. Welcome. The beginning with Turkey, where people are heading back to the polls in a presidential runoff that pits incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan against opposition leader Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Some 64 million people are eligible to elect the president for the next 5 years. Erdogan is seen as favorite to extend his two decades of rule. He secured more than 49.5% of the ballots in the first round, narrowly missing out an outright victory. Kılıçdaroğlu came second with less than 45%. Erdogan has also secured the endorsement of the third-place candidate Sinan Oğan. Key election issues are the economy, quake relief operations, and refugees. Okay, now let's go to Istanbul and get an update. Our correspondent Rashan Saglam has been there and watching all this. Rashan, tell us about it. Is it going smoothly? What's up?
Yes, as you mentioned, 64 million citizens are eligible to vote in Turkey. And now you said if it's going smoothly, it was going smoothly until an hour from now. A fight broke out in one of Istanbul's districts between supporters inside one of the polling stations, supporters of President Erdogan, and supporters and observers of the elections that are supporting the opposition candidate Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. And apparently the fight took place when one of the observers of Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who is a lawyer, wanted to go and check the vote, how it's going in the polling station. However, he did not have an accreditation previously, and he was prevented from the police and supporters of President Erdogan from going inside the polling station, and he was escorted outside of the polling station. A fight, while he was being escorted, a fight broke out between supporters of both political candidates or presidential candidates. However, the police interfered and they broke out the fight. Now, it's mainly going smoothly, as I mentioned, all over Turkey. The High Electoral Committee said that things are going really easily and fast and calmly. And this is, I think, due to the people only having to choose between two candidates, President Erdogan and Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, as we are only in the runoff voting for the presidential election. In the previous round, people had to vote for the presidential election and parliamentary election. However, the parliamentary was already chosen by the people last time. This time, we are only seeing the presidential one. The two candidates are, as I mentioned, the People Alliance candidate, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and the Nation Alliance candidate, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. For the first time, the Turkish opposition were able to name one single candidate and agree on him. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, as per some political analysts and as per his political partners in the CHP, Republican People's Party, have high chances of winning. Just like today, the Istanbul municipality leader or head İmamoğlu, Ekrem İmamoğlu, said that or told Kılıçdaroğlu, we are going to celebrate your victory in Ankara tonight. Just after his vote in Beylikdüzü, this is what he told Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Also on the other side, President Erdogan seems to be sure of the win, as after casting his vote with his wife Emine Erdoğan in Üsküdar district in Istanbul, he also told the press that we are heading to Ankara to celebrate with our people, just like we do every year from the balcony of the AKP headquarters in Ankara. Now, of course, Kılıçdaroğlu did cast his vote in Ankara, while Erdogan casted his vote in Istanbul, and he is also heading to Ankara. So both leaders and candidates will be following the results from Ankara. As I mentioned previously, Ankara, Izmir, and Istanbul have the highest number of votes. People are nearly 90% in those three cities voting today. However, in other villages, in other cities, in other provinces, the number is not as high as Ankara, Istanbul, and Izmir. I think that the competition in those cities is higher usually. In Istanbul, 6 million people are eligible to vote. In Ankara, 4 million people are eligible to vote. And those are the biggest cities where people, or the most dense cities where people vote in Turkey, and the most important ones actually for both the opposition and the ruling party, of course. Now, also, we have to mention that the youth are mainly supporting the opposition candidate, speaking to people, mainly young people. When asking them, who are you voting for, they mainly say that they are voting for Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. And when asking why, they say that they want more freedoms in the country, better economy, that's why they support him. And when asking people who are a little bit older, not voting for the first time, they say that they are supporting President Erdogan because they want stability in the country.
I see. Okay, we'll have to wait and see. Thank you so much for that, Rashan Saglam, our correspondent in Istanbul. Now, moving on, tens of thousands of people have yet again, for the fifth month, flocked the streets of Tel Aviv protesting Prime Minister Netanyahu's proposed judicial overhaul. The consecutive weekly protests have seen some success in that the plan has not been approved as quickly as Netanyahu had hoped. But it seems that the Prime Minister and his far-right cabinet remain committed to pushing through the changes, despite being under immense pressure both at home and abroad to scrap the plan. Netanyahu agreed to delay the overhaul to try to negotiate with the opposition a middle ground, but after a shift in focus to passing to annual budget last week, the highly contested plan is again at the forefront. Economists have warned that an independent court system is crucial and that the plan would further isolate the Israeli regime internationally. Now, anti-war activist Richard Becker joined us earlier, and he told us why Netanyahu's far-right cabinet is so adamant to push through the reform plan.
If they do not go through with the plan, if the plan does not pass, or if it's not ratified by the Knesset, the parliament, then the coalition government that presently exists will collapse. This extreme right-wing government that has actual fascists in it is built on the idea that they can go forward with plans to annex the West Bank and other territories as well and dispossess more of the Palestinian population. But again, the big problem here is that today, in what was the British Mandate or colony of Palestine, the Palestinian population and the Israeli population are about the same. The Palestinian population is probably a little bigger. But whether they live in West Bank or they live in Gaza or they live inside the 1948 borders of Israel, all in different forms, but all of this Palestinian population suffers under a form of apartheid. And as for long as that issue is not addressed, and so far, the protests have not addressed that and have avoided it and even suppressed people with Palestinian flags coming to the demonstrations. Unless that changes, I don't think there can be any real change in the state of it.
Dozens of Israeli settlers, heavily guarded by forces, have broken into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the Akbar al-Quds and performed rituals there. This is not the first time that the settlers stormed a mosque that's revered by Palestinians and other Muslims as an Islamic holy site. Since 2003, the regime has allowed settlers into the compound almost on a daily basis. Now, Palestinians dismiss the settlers' presence at the mosque as provocative. Tensions have been running high between Palestinians and Israeli settlers over the latter's trespassing on the holy site. Israel captured East Al-Quds, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is located, in 1967. Ukraine says the Russian troops have temporarily eased attacks in and around the flashpoint city of Bakhmut to regroup and strengthen their capabilities. Now, Russia says its forces have completely taken over the city, but Kyiv says it still controls pockets of Bakhmut. The battle for the city has been the longest and bloodiest in the war. The capture would bring Russia slightly closer to its goal of controlling the whole Donetsk region. Meantime, Ukraine says it will soon launch a highly anticipated counteroffensive. Ukrainian defense officials say that the push could start as soon as tomorrow or ultimately by the end of the week. Ukraine says the offensive aims to recapture territory taken by Russia since the beginning of the war. Now, according to Ukraine, at least one person has been killed and another injured after Russia unleashed a major two-wave overnight air attack on Kyiv. Several districts of the capital, by far the largest Ukrainian city with a population around 3 million, suffered in the overnight attacks. According to the mayor, the raid was conducted by drones, who says that air defense systems downed at least 20 unmanned aircraft. Moscow has intensified missile and drone strikes in Kyiv this month after a lull of nearly 2 months targeting military facilities and supplies. Tens of thousands of Serbs have taken to the streets of Belgrade in an anti-government protest over two mass shootings that killed 18 people. Now, the crowd surrounded a compound housing the state broadcaster, calling for the resignation of the Serbian president. They also demanded more media freedom. That was the fourth such protest organized by opposition parties. They accused the government of failing to rein in media that have promoted violence and to act against criminal elements in society. The government denies opposition parties' allegations, accusing them of staging protests for political gains. On the 3rd of May, a young boy killed 9 students and a security guard in Belgrade in the first mass shooting in Serbia. A day later, a 21-year-old man killed 8 others outside the city. French police brutality against protesters continues to occur, and one group which knows plenty about that subject are the Yellow Vest anti-government protesters. They still gather every Saturday nationwide, and do so despite regular harassment by the police and judges. Rami Mazari has more from Paris.
When climate activists were tear-gassed, abused, and arrested by police in Paris, the Western mainstream media broadcast shock and alarm at state brutality towards nonviolent protesters. Many of France's Yellow Vests were glad the subject was reported upon, but the group, which has been subject to more French police brutality than any group in recent memory, wonders why their weekly protests and mistreatment are still under a media blackout.
Every Saturday for nearly 5 years, the Yellow Vests have been in the streets. In the big cities and the small towns, we make our legitimate demands for democratic and economic rights, and we won't stop until we get them.
Many were shocked this month when a woman who was not participating in a 2019 Yellow Vest demonstration and had been shot in the neck by a tear gas grenade was just judged to be co-responsible for her injuries. The judge said that the mother, who had gotten lost in a strange city while visiting her daughter, should have known that serious incidents had occurred at recent protests. The decision refused to find fault with the state's actions, seems to negate a citizen's right to travel freely, and will likely scare many away from even observing a Yellow Vest protest.
Un état totalitaire.
We aren't in a dictatorship, but in a totalitarian situation. The state wants everybody to keep quiet and to agree with whatever they say. This lack of democracy is why the Yellow Vests began in the first place. It wasn't over just gas prices. This woman's situation is one dramatic situation, but there are so, so many others like her.
On June 6th, a million-person march is expected, the 15th this year, in the ongoing fight against a 2-year hike to the retirement age by presidential decree. Police brutality is expected to be even more rampant than at the previous such march on May 1st.
Pour leur physique de venir en manifestation.
The people are afraid for their own physical safety when they come to a protest now. There are so many arrests, so much violence, and constant tear gas. This is the reason why the number of people joining us dropped, even as our national problems keep growing worse.
Besides their Saturday marches, The yellow vests are present at seemingly every public protest in France and often around Europe as well. They regularly contend that they are willfully ignored by the government and media because the basis of their movement is economic and political redistribution. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Now, Britain's health minister says the government will not hold talks on pay with the nurses' union as it's gearing up for new strikes. Steve Barclay says negotiations will continue, but not on the amount of pay. The government has adhered to its April offer for a lump payment plus a 5% raise for the current year. But the Royal College of Nursing, which represents nurses, has rejected the offer. The union says health staff must be paid fairly. The RCP is already balloting its 300,000 members on further industrial action. Nurses and other health staff have staged highly disruptive rolling strikes over wages amid raging inflation. The government has responded by imposing curbs on the length of the strike. At least three people have been killed and several others injured in clashes between Iranian troops and Taliban forces along the border between Iran and Afghanistan. According to Iranian media, two border guards were killed and two others injured after Taliban forces opened fire at a checkpoint along the border with Afghanistan. Taliban officials say that one of their forces was killed and another one was wounded. They say that the situation is now under control. The Iranian police chief has ordered border guards to, quote, bravely and resolutely defend the country against anyone trying to trespass or approach the borders. The police chief has also warned Afghan authorities are responsible for any action that's unwise and a violation of international law. And that brings to the end of this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023.
I am not saying that you should get martyred. I pray to God that you don't get martyred. Of course, it's fine if you do when you are at an old age. But wait until you're 70 or 80 years old and then get martyred. We need you now while you're still young. Don't get martyred, but live like a martyr. Live like these people and take actions like them. The evil powers are very much against this group. My dear young people, follow the clear path with determination. Follow the clear path of the revolution, Islam, the country, the system, and the like with determination. Our country needs you. You need ideals. One of the few things that is truly needed on the path is idealism. You need hope. You need rationality. You need these. Idealism means looking at distant horizons. As I mentioned, movement is not possible without this. Idealism is the propelling force of a movement. Hope is the fuel of this engine.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Without hope, this engine will not move. I will keep thinking and worrying about idealism if there is no hope. And rationality is the steering wheel for this engine. You must think rationally, act wisely, and move forward. As for universities, I have much to say about them. You also spoke about them, and what you said is correct. The problems you mentioned exist. What I want to say is that the lack of a truly comprehensive scientific plan is a great shortcoming in our universities today. We don't know what basis is used for the distribution of students in various scientific fields of study. These scientific courses of study should be in fields that are needed in the country. They must benefit the country. How many students do we need in a certain field? These matters should be considered, and work needs to be done on this. I'd like to ask the Honourable Minister of Science, he's probably among us here, to pursue this matter. It is one of the important tasks that you need to do.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. Countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK Special Forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the US and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly, now the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq and obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And I say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West's proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the U.S. comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the US and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western military district units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morope during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by the Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's defense forces' capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morope, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law, is mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world as we live today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister James Morope said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island.
Morape also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggests that Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Morape of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang from the People's National Congress said last week, "We should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run." He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none. In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards the Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bagheri said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly. The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th Flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters, not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pit.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamadi. Islamadi. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon him, I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. This is IRIB English Radio. I am Asma, and here we have Zainab with us.
Assalamu alaikum, dear Asma and dear listeners. Very warm welcome. We are on Youth Station.
Yes.
I have had this pleasure to co-host with Sister Asma.
Of course, the pleasure is all mine. Youth Station is just like home, so whenever we are here, it feels so much home.
Right.
Yeah, I hope everyone is doing well. And how are you doing, Zainab?
Alhamdulillah, I'm fine, Asma, and I hope everyone around is doing good.
Yeah, yes, of course, because, you know, these days we all hear stories and things and... Yeah, everything seems to be sad sometimes, yeah. But that's the way
and
of life.
And what's important is that it's very difficult to forget those things.
Yes, you are just hitting the nail on the head. Yes, to forget sad things. But you know, there's this question that I'd very much like to ask you. Which one do you think is harder, to be forgotten or to forget?
In one or the other way, both are difficult one.
But you know, I guess, to forget people and things is easier because you are the one who is doing that. So you don't understand that you're forgetting something. But to be forgotten is very sad because it is as if you have been omitted from the world.
It feels to us like that. But when I say that I found forgetting things as well difficult, was mm-hmm. again the same thing that we started with. Forgetting sad things is very difficult. So
yeah.
If you have like, I just heard...
Sometimes it's a blessing to forget.
Yeah, it is indeed. Indeed, it's a blessing to forget. Like we just had a colleague of ours who just passed away in accident just 1 week ago. And
so sad.
It's really hard to forget these things. It's mm-hmm. really forget. But, you know, with time we do forget. Like this colleague of mine was just 24 years old. And his mother, if she does not forget this, it would be like a disaster for her. Mm-hmm. So forgetting is it is a blessing from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And
But it does not happen easily.
Yeah. But when it comes to like, you know, being selfish, materialistic and like, you know, very self-centered, to forget things is very, very easy. But then, to be forgotten is really much heavier, I agree with you, than to forget things.
Yeah. Because when you forget things, you are doing that. So maybe you do not just understand the amount of pressure that is coming after, the consequence of forgetting.
Right.
But when you are forgotten, things are pretty much difficult.
No, because it's in our pocket. it's being, like we are being attacked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now it's about us. It's about self.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. It's...
But in some other times, to forget is also, I don't know, I call it a punishment. Or something, because sometimes you happen to forget things without even being aware of the fact that you're forgetting things. Like we have it in the Holy Book of Quran that I'm just saying the concept of that verse that says, Allah says that we make them forget us, you know, the remembrance of Allah. The people would forget that. And then just imagine, if I forget God, then things would come so nasty in my life without me even knowing them.
Yeah. I do agree. Yeah. I don't know why mankind is like that, but yeah, it sometimes seems to me like we are, just because of our selfishness, we forget things. And sometimes it's just because it's not in our hands.
It could have many reasons.
Sometimes
you know?
It's not in our hands that we forget things. Sometimes it's... because of many other reasons. But what is important is that what to forget, what not to forget.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are some things, really, we should be forgetting them and, like, moving on in life. Because if we stick with some things all the time in our life, we won't be able to move on in our life. Sometimes we get stick to some very nonsense things.
Like, yeah.
Especially, like, you know, we as girls, we have something... this emotional factor is very, very, you know, strong. And then we are emotionally attached to so many things, mm-hmm. which
and
really are not necessary.
Like this, we're forgetting something, Zainab.
To have a sip of water.
Yes, exactly. We're forgetting to have a break. So we have to go for it in a blink of an eye, and then we'll be back. Yes, you're listening to Youth Station. This is IRIB English Radio. I am here with my dear Zainab, and we're talking about forgetting. To forget and to be forgotten.
Yeah. I was saying that sometimes we as women are like, you know, emotionally stuck to some things, and it's really important to move on in life, stuck to some important things than very emotional or like unimportant things. So at that point of time, forgetting is important.
Yeah.
But there are also some points as well where I think that forgetting is like disastrous.
A crisis that happens.
Right.
Yeah.
Like what?
Like whenever we have parents that are far away from us. Yeah. They're living in another city and we just even forget to call them.
Ask me.
Yeah.
Ask me. It's a disastrous thing. And sometimes if I forget to call them, it's okay for me. It sounds very okay to me. But if they forget to call me, yeah, I make things disastrous for them.
Yeah, but, you know,
because here I feel like I have been forgotten.
Yes, exactly.
But when I forget...
And that hurts.
Yeah, but when I forget, I take it very easy. And that should not be happening. Like the way I don't like to be forgotten, I should not be forgetting as well.
The old people, you know, as we get older, we understand the feeling that our grandparents had. You know, they became so happy whenever many guests came to their houses. And we just didn't notice the fact that, okay, they have been so lonely for so long. So when someone comes to their home, it's as if they have got wings to fly with. So these things are very small things, but they have great effects on the elderly to visit them, to not to forget them. Even with a calling, with a simple calling, you can ask how they're doing, and then I guess that would do the trick for them.
Right. So Asma, there's this word in sound for human being, and which has some link with forgetting.
Yeah. Insan comes from nisyan. The word nisyan in Arabic means forgetting.
Yeah.
So I guess it has got something to do with the nature of human beings, essence of a human being that has got linked with the word forgetting.
Yeah.
And as I just told you, it's a blessing because as human beings, we get so attracted to things, so linked to things, that we just don't want to get away from them. But just imagine all these people who are living in this world, they lose their parents, they lose their dear ones. If they did not forget, at least for a temporary time, at least for a short time, they would die. They would die of the much of sadness that has been poured into their heart.
And sometimes, like you said, forgetting is... We don't realize we're forgetting things.
Exactly. Now, but this one is very, very bad.
Yeah, we don't realize with time. See, Asma, like I have been, I think it's been 8 years I'm living in some other country, and I really don't have contact with all my dear ones I used to have long before. And sometimes if like after 8 years I get in touch with someone and then we start discussing, calling, chatting with each other, they remind me of things I really don't remember.
Yeah.
But that had happened, you know, in the past. Those
exactly.
things have
had
been in
needs.
Me. And they sometimes remind me of some of my traits, which I really don't even realize, which I have not even focused upon. And then I feel pity upon myself. Why do I forget? Mm-hmm. Why don't I know that? Why don't I, when she can remember things, what has happened to me? Why don't I remember things? But I know at the same time when I am chatting with my old friend, when I'm telling her about some of the traits that I remember, I realize that even she does not remember what I am talking about.
You know, that's the whole idea behind living in this world, that we have it in the Holy Book of Quran, that this life is a test. Yeah. So we have been tested with many things, with our family, with our business that we have it in our... during our daily life, you know? So we have too many things to do, and it depends on our priorities, which one respect more to take care of more. And if you take it this way, then taking care of other people is very much important, not to forget to visit our family, to talk to them, to share moments with them, and all of these things, these quality time that we can spend with other people that are dear to us are very important, even if they are very short.
Right.
So what do you say if we go for a short break and then come back to give the gist of all the story of today's episode?
Yes, I do agree. Let's go for a short break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yes, the word forgetting might have so much of bad connotation, but we said that sometimes it has got a positive point in it for the times when you have to forget something bad that has happened to you, for the time that you have to move on in your life. It's good to forget, and it's good to work on it to forget. But we said that the bad types of forgetting is when you forget your dear ones, your responsibilities in this world, the duties that you have as an obedient of Allah, as a servant of Allah. You should not forget your responsibilities and duties. And according to me, and according also to all the verses that we have in the Holy Book of Quran, forgetting Allah is the worst kind of forgetting that could ever happen to a person.
Exactly.
Because just as you forget it, you would get deviated from the right path of prosperity.
Indeed. This is the worst form of forgetting, especially where we have come from, where we're going, what is our goal in this world.
Exactly, yeah.
This is something a person should, you know, always remind himself.
I do agree that this life gets us so engaged in a way that we feel in all these hustles and bustles of everyday life, we really forget many things. Even sometimes we forget ourselves, our true selves. We forget to talk to ourselves every night to see, what have I done? Have I done something
analyze
wrong?
And contemplate things.
Exactly, to contemplate on myself.
Right.
We even forget that. But as I just told you, all of these forgetting comes from the point that we do not devote a time not to forget Allah.
Exactly.
To speak to Him, to, you know, bear your soul out to Him and then have Him as a shoulder.
And He has, He's so merciful. He's so merciful, and He has kept a lot of ways for us to remind Him from time to time.
So, you know, my brother always tells me that whenever I'm so busy in my life and things get so speedy, something happens that makes me stay and have a break and think of God more and more.
Exactly.
Because the reason behind of all these things that happen all together in a way that makes me so busy, I feel like, okay, I need to rest for
take a
while.
Take a break.
And think and, you know, have a chit-chat with Allah. And to see, where are we headed?
Exactly.
Am I in the true path
or no? I think that that's exactly happening because of this busy life, fast
yeah,
life,
modernism. Modernism is bringing too much of disasters.
Especially the tech world, you have so much screen time, and then you really forget what I have put on the gas stove, where I have kept my, I don't know, other accessories. And
exactly.
Unfortunately, for most of the people, they remember all the forgotten things in Salat.
Exactly. Yeah, they remember everything there. So, Zainab, I wish we could have had more time to talk about it, because this is a very interesting topic. Forgetting has got too many things in it.
Yeah.
But then that's time, and it's flying so fast, and we have to say bye.
Yeah, and I hope you don't forget me ever.
Of course. So, dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Wish you best of luck in your life, and may God be always on your side. Wassalamu alaikum.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu.
Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South.